Chapter 9. The Ludic Fallacy, or the Uncertainty of the Nerd. Fat Tony. Fat Tony is one of Nero's friends who irritates Yevgenia Krasnova beyond measure. We should perhaps more thoughtfully style him Horizontally Challenged Tony, since he is not as objectively overweight as his nickname indicates. It's just that his body shape makes whatever he wears seem ill-fitted. He wears only tailored suits, many of them cut for him in Rome, but they look as if he bought them from a web catalog. He has thick hands, hairy fingers, wears a gold wrist chain, and reeks of licorice candies that he devours in industrial quantities as a substitute for an old smoking habit. He doesn't usually mind people calling him Fat Tony, but he much prefers to be called just Tony. Nero calls him, more politely, Brooklyn Tony, because of his accent and his Brooklyn way of thinking, though Tony is one of the prosperous Brooklyn people who moved to New Jersey 20 years ago. Tony's a successful non-nerd with a happy disposition. He leads a gregarious existence. His sole visible problem seems to be his weight, and the corresponding nagging by his family, remote cousins, and friends, who keep warning him about that premature heart attack. Nothing seems to work. Tony often goes to a fat farm in Arizona to not eat, lose a few pounds, then gain almost all of them back in his first-class seat on the flight back. It's remarkable how his self-control and personal discipline, otherwise admirable, fail to apply to his waistline. He started as a clerk in the back office of a New York bank in the early 1980s, in the letter of credit department. He pushed papers and did some grunt work. Later, he grew into giving small business loans and figured out the game of how you can get financing from the monster banks, how their bureaucracies operate, and what they like to see on paper. All the while an employee, he started acquiring property in bankruptcy proceedings, buying it from financial institutions. His big insight is that bank employees who sell you a house that's not theirs just don't care as much as the owners. Tony knew very rapidly how to talk to them and maneuver. Later, he also learned to buy and sell gas stations with money borrowed from small neighborhood bankers. Tony has this remarkable habit of trying to make a buck effortlessly, just for entertainment, without straining, without office work, without meeting, just by melding his deals into his private life. Tony's motto is finding who the sucker is. Obviously, they are often the banks. The clerks don't care about nothing. Finding these suckers is second nature to him. If you took walks around the block with Tony, you would feel considerably more informed about the texture of the world just talking to him. Tony is remarkably gifted at getting unlisted phone numbers, first-class seats on airlines for no additional money, or your car in a garage that is officially full, either through connections or his forceful charm. Non-Brooklyn John. I found the perfect non-Brooklyn in someone I will call Dr. John. He's a former engineer currently working as an actuary for an insurance company. He's thin, wiry, and wears glasses and a dark suit. He lives in New Jersey, not far from Fat Tony, but certainly they rarely run into each other. Tony never takes the train, and actually never commutes. He drives a Cadillac and sometimes his wife's Italian convertible, and jokes that he's more visible than the rest of the car. Dr. John is a master of the schedule. He's as predictable as a clock. He quietly and efficiently reads the newspaper on the train to Manhattan, then neatly folds it for the lunchtime continuation. While Tony makes restaurant owners rich, they beam when they see him coming and exchange noisy hugs with him, John meticulously packs his sandwich every morning, fruit salad in a plastic container. As for his clothing, he also wears a suit that looks like it came from a web catalog, except that it's quite likely that it actually did. Dr. John is a painstaking, reasoned, and gentle fellow. He takes his work seriously, so seriously that, unlike Tony, You can see a line in the sand between his working time and his leisure activities. He has a PhD in electrical engineering from the University of Texas at Austin. Since he knows both computers and statistics, he was hired by an insurance company to do computer simulations. He enjoys the business. Much of what he does consists of running computer programs for risk management. I know that it's rare for Fat Tony and Dr. John to breathe the same air, let alone find themselves at the same bar. So consider this a pure thought exercise. I'll ask each of them a question and compare their answers. NNT, that is, me. Assume that a coin is fair, i.e. has an equal probability of coming up heads or tails when flipped. I flip it 99 times and get heads each time. What are the odds of my getting tails on my next throw? Dr. John. Trivial question. One half, of course, since you're assuming 50% odds for each and independence between draws. NNT. What do you say, Tony? Fat Tony. I say no more than 1%, of course. NNT. Why so? I gave you the initial assumption of a fair coin, meaning that it was 50% either way. Fat Tony. You're either full of crap or a pure sucker to buy that 50% business. The coin gotta be loaded. It can't be a fair game. Translation. It's far more likely that your assumptions about the fairness are wrong than the coin delivering 99 heads in 99 throws. NNT. But Dr. John said 50%. Fat Tony, whispering in my ear. I know these guys with the nerd examples from the bank days. They think way too slow, and they're too commoditized. You can take them for a ride. Now, of the two of them, which would you favor for the position of mayor of New York City, or Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia? Dr. John thinks entirely within the box that was given to him. Fat Tony, almost entirely outside the box. To set the terminology straight, what I call a nerd here doesn't have to look sloppy, unaesthetic, and sallow, and wear glasses and a portable computer on his belt as if it were an ostensible weapon. A nerd is simply someone who thinks exceedingly inside the box. Have you ever wondered why so many of these straight-A students end up going nowhere in life, while someone who lagged behind is now getting the shekels, buying the diamonds, and getting his phone calls returned? Or even getting the Nobel Prize in a real discipline, say, medicine? Some of this may have something to do with luck and outcomes, but there is this sterile and obscurantist quality that is often associated with classroom knowledge that may get in the way of understanding what's going on in real life. In an IQ test, as well as in any academic setting, including sports, Dr. John would vastly outperform Fat Tony. But Fat Tony would outperform Dr. John in any other possible ecological, real-life situation. In fact, Tony, in spite of his lack of culture, has an enormous curiosity about the texture of reality, and his own erudition, to me, is more scientific in the literal, though not in the social sense, than Dr. John. We will get deep, very deep, into the difference between the answers of Fat Tony and Dr. John. This is probably the most vexing problem I know about the connections between two varieties of knowledge, what we dub Platonic and aplatonic. Simply, people like Dr. John can cause black swans outside Mediocristan. Their minds are closed. While the problem is very general, one of its nastiest illusions is what I call the ludic fallacy. The attributes of the uncertainty we face in real life have little connection to the sterilized ones we encounter in exams and games. So, I close part one with the following story. Lunch at Lake Como. One spring day a few years ago, I was surprised to receive an invitation from a think tank sponsored by the United States Defense Department to a brainstorming session on risk that was to take place in Las Vegas the following fall. The person who invited me announced on the phone, "We'll have lunch on a terrace overlooking Lake Como," which put me in a state of severe distress. Las Vegas, along with its sibling, the Emirate of Dubai, is perhaps one place I'd never wish to visit before I die. Lunch at Fake Como would be torture. But I'm glad I went. The think tank had gathered a non-political collection of people they called doers and scholars, and practitioners like me who do not accept the distinction, involved in uncertainty in a variety of disciplines. And they symbolically picked a major casino as a venue. The symposium was a closed-doors, synod-style assembly of people who would never have mixed otherwise. My first surprise was to discover that the military people there thought, behaved, and acted like philosophers, far more so than the philosophers we'll see splitting hairs in their weekly colloquium in Part 3. They thought out of the box, like traders, except much better and without fear of introspection. An assistant secretary of defense was among us, but had I not known his profession, I would have thought he was a practitioner of skeptical empiricism. Even an engineering investigator who had examined the cause of a space shuttle explosion was thoughtful and open-minded. I came out of the meeting realizing that only military people deal with randomness with genuine, introspective, intellectual honesty, unlike academics and corporate executives using other people's money. This doesn't show in war movies, where they're usually portrayed as war-hungry autocrats. The people in front of me were not the people who initiate wars. Indeed, for many, the successful defense policy is the one that manages to eliminate potential dangers without war, such as the strategy of bankrupting the Russians through the escalation in defense spending. When I expressed my amazement to Lawrence, another finance person who was sitting next to me, he told me that the military collected more genuine intellects and risk thinkers than most, if not all, other professions. Defense people wanted to understand the epistemology of risk. In the group was a gentleman who ran a group of professional gamblers and who was banned from most casinos. He'd come to share his wisdom with us. He sat not far from a stuffy professor of political science, dry like a bone, and, as is characteristic of big names, careful about his reputation, who said nothing out of the box and who didn't smile once. During the sessions, I tried to imagine the hotshot with a rat dropped down his back, putting him in a state of wriggling panic. He was perhaps good at writing platonic models of something called game theory, but when Lawrence and I went after him on his improper use of financial metaphors, he lost all his arrogance. Now, when you think of the major risks casinos face, gambling situations come to mind. In a casino, one would think, the risks include lucky gamblers blowing up the house with a series of large wins, and cheaters taking away money through devious methods. It isn't just the general public that would believe so, but the casino management as well. Consequently, the casino had a high-tech surveillance system tracking cheaters, card counters, and other people who try to derive an advantage over them. Each of the participants gave his presentation and listened to those of the others. I came to discuss black swans, and I intended to tell them that the only thing I know is that we know precious little about them, but that it was their property to sneak up on us, and that attempts at platonifying them led to additional misunderstandings. Military people can understand such things, and the idea became recently prevalent in military circles with the expression unknown unknown, as opposed to the known unknown. But I'd prepared my talk on 5 restaurant napkins, some stained, and was ready to discuss a new phrase I coined for the occasion, the ludic fallacy. I intended to tell them that I shouldn't be speaking at a casino because it had nothing to do with uncertainty. The uncertainty of the nerd. What is the ludic fallacy? Ludic comes from ludus, Latin for games. I was hoping that the representatives of the casino would speak before me, so I could start harassing them by showing politely that a casino was precisely the venue not to pick for such a discussion, since the class of risks casinos encounter are very insignificant outside of the building, and their study not readily transferable. My idea is that gambling was sterilized and domesticated uncertainty. In the casino, you know the rules. You can calculate the odds. And the type of uncertainty we encounter there, we'll see later, is mild, belonging to mediocristan. My prepared statement was this. The casino is the only human venture I know where the probabilities are known, Gaussian, i.e. bell curve, and almost computable. You cannot expect the casino to pay out a million times your bet or to change the rules abruptly on you during the game. There are never days in which 36 black is designed to pop up 95% of the time. My colleague Mark Spitznagel found a martial version of the ludic fallacy. Organized competitive fighting trains the athlete to focus on the game and, in order not to dissipate his concentration, to ignore the possibility of what is not specifically allowed by the rules, such as kicks to the groin, a surprise knife, etc. So those who win the gold medal might be precisely those who will be most vulnerable in real life. Likewise, you see people with huge muscles in black t-shirts who can impress you in the artificial environment of the gym, but are unable to lift a stone. In real life, you don't know the odds. You need to discover them, and the sources of uncertainty aren't defined. Economists who don't consider what was discovered by non-economists worthwhile draw an artificial distinction between 19 risks, which you can compute, and 19 uncertainty, which you can't compute, after one Frank Knight, who rediscovered the notion of unknown uncertainty and did a lot of thinking, but perhaps never took risks, or perhaps lived in the vicinity of a casino. Had he taken economic or financial risks, he would have realized that these computable risks are largely absent from real life. They're laboratory contraptions. Yet, we automatically, spontaneously associate chance with these platonified games. I find it infuriating to listen to people who, upon being informed that I specialize in problems of chance, immediately shower me with references to dice. Two illustrators for a paperback edition of one of my books spontaneously and independently added a die to the cover and below every chapter, throwing me into a state of rage. The editor, familiar with my thinking, warned them to avoid the ludic fallacy, as if it were a well-known intellectual violation. Amusingly, they both reacted with an, "Ah, sorry, we didn't know." Those who spend too much time with their noses glued to maps will tend to mistake the map for the territory. Go by a recent history of probability and probabilistic thinking, you'll be showered with names of alleged probability thinkers who all base their ideas on these sterilized constructs. I recently looked at what college students are taught under the subject of chance and came out horrified. They were brainwashed with this ludic fallacy and the outlandish bell curve. The same is true of people doing PhDs in the field of probability theory. I'm reminded of a recent book by a thoughtful mathematician, Amir Akzel, called Chance. Excellent book, perhaps, but like all other modern books, it's grounded in the ludic fallacy. Furthermore, assuming chance has anything to do with mathematics, what little mathematization we can do in the real world doesn't assume the mild randomness represented by the bell curve, but rather scalable, wild randomness. What can be mathematized is usually not Gaussian, but Mandelbrotian. Now go read any of the classical thinkers who had something practical to say about the subject of chance, such as Cicero, and you find something different. A notion of probability that remains fuzzy throughout, as it needs to be, since such fuzziness is the very nature of uncertainty. Probability is a liberal art. It's a child of skepticism, not a tool for people with calculators on their belts to satisfy their desire to produce fancy calculations and certainties. Before Western thinking drowned in its scientific mentality, what is arrogantly called the Enlightenment, people prompted their brain to think, not compute. In a beautiful treatise now vanished from our consciousness, Dissertation on the Search for Truth, published in 1673, the polemist Simon Fouché exposed our psychological predilection for certainties. He teaches us the art of doubting, how to position ourselves between doubting and believing. He writes, "One needs to exit doubt in order to produce science, but few people heed the importance of not exiting from it prematurely. It's a fact that one usually exits doubt without realizing it." He warns us further, "We are dogma prone from our mother's wombs." By the confirmation error discussed earlier, we use the example of games, which probability theory was successful at tracking, and claim that this is a general case. Furthermore, just as we tend to underestimate the role of luck in life in general, we tend to overestimate it in games of chance. This building is inside the Platonic fold. Life stands outside of it, I wanted to shout. Gambling with the wrong dice. I was in for quite a surprise when I learned that the building, too, was outside the Platonic fold. The casino's risk management, aside from setting its gambling policies, was geared toward reducing the losses resulting from cheaters. One doesn't need heavy training in probability theory to understand that the casino was sufficiently diversified across the different tables to not have to worry about taking a hit from an extremely lucky gambler. The diversification argument that leads to the bell curve, as we will see in Chapter 15. All they had to do was control the whales, the high rollers flown in at the casino's expense from Manila or Hong Kong. Whales can swing several million dollars in a gambling bout. Absent cheating, the performance of most individual gamblers would be the equivalent of a drop in the bucket, making the aggregate very stable. I promise not to discuss any of the details of the casino's sophisticated surveillance system. All I'm allowed to say is that I felt transported into a James Bond movie. I wondered if the casino was an imitation of the movies, or if it was the other way around. Yet in spite of such sophistication, their risks had nothing to do with what can be anticipated knowing that their business is a casino. For it turned out the four largest losses incurred or narrowly avoided by the casino fell completely outside their sophisticated models. First, they lost around $100 million when an irreplaceable performer in their main show was maimed by a tiger. The show, Siegfried and Roy, had been a major Las Vegas attraction. The tiger had been reared by the performer and even slept in his bedroom. Until then, nobody suspected that the powerful animal would turn against its master. In scenario analyses, the casino had even conceived of the animal jumping into the crowd, but nobody came near to the idea of insuring against what happened. Second, a disgruntled contractor was hurt during the construction of a hotel annex. He was so offended by the settlement offered him that he made an attempt to dynamite the casino. His plan was to put explosives around the pillars in the basement. The attempt was, of course, thwarted, otherwise, to use the arguments earlier, we wouldn't have been there. But I shivered at the thought of possibly sitting above a pile of dynamite. Third, casinos must file a special form with the Internal Revenue Service documenting a gambler's profit if it exceeds a given amount. The employee who was supposed to mail the forms hid them instead, for completely unexplainable reasons, in boxes under his desk. This went on for years without anyone noticing that something was wrong. The employee's refraining from sending the documents was truly impossible to predict. Tax violations and negligence being serious offenses, the casino faced the near loss of a gambling license or the onerous financial costs of a suspension. Clearly, they ended up paying a monstrous fine, an undisclosed amount, which was the luckiest way out of the problem. Fourth, there was a spate of other dangerous scenes, such as the kidnapping of the casino owner's daughter, which caused him, in order to secure cash for the ransom, to violate gambling laws by dipping into the casino coffers. Conclusion? A back-of-the-envelope calculation shows that the dollar value of these black swans, the off-model hits and potential hits I've just outlined, swamp the on-model risks by a factor of close to 1,000 to 1. The casino spent hundreds of millions of dollars on gambling theory and high-tech surveillance, while the bulk of their risks came from outside their models. All this, and yet the rest of the world still learns about uncertainty and probability from gambling examples. Wrapping up part one. The cosmetic rises to the surface. All of the topics in part one are actually only one. You can think about a subject for a long time to the point of being possessed by it. Somehow you have a lot of ideas, but they don't seem explicitly connected. The logic linking them remains concealed from you. Yet you know deep down that all these are the same idea. Meanwhile, what Nietzsche calls Bildungsphilisters, or learned Philistines, blue collars of the thinking business, tell you that you are spread out between fields. You reply that these disciplines are artificial and arbitrary, to no avail. What Nietzsche means by Bildungsphilisters are the dogma-prone newspaper readers and opera lovers who have cosmetic exposure to culture and shallow depth. I extend the term here to the Philistine hiding in academia, who lacks an erudition out of lack of curiosity and is closely centered on his ideas. So you tell these learned Philistines that you're a limousine driver, and they leave you alone. You feel better because you don't identify with them, and thus you no longer need to be amputated to fit into the Procrustean bed of the disciplines. Finally, a little push, and you see that it was all one single problem. One evening, I found myself at a cocktail party in Munich, at the apartment of a former art historian who had more art books in its library than I thought existed. I stood drinking excellent Riesling in the spontaneously formed English-speaking corner of the apartment, in the hope of getting to a state where I would be able to start speaking my brand of fake German. One of the most insightful thinkers I know, the computer entrepreneur Yossi Vardi, prompted me to summarize my idea while standing on one leg. It was not too convenient to stand on one leg after a few glasses of perfumed Riesling, so I failed in my improvisation. The next day, I experienced staircase wit. I jumped out of bed with the following idea. The cosmetic and the platonic rise naturally to the surface. This is a simple extension of the problem of knowledge. It's simply that one side of Eco's library, the one we never see, has the property of being ignored. This is also the problem of silent evidence. It's why we don't see black swans. We worry about those that happened, not those that may happen but didn't. It is why we platonify, liking known schemas and well-organized knowledge to the point of blindness to reality. It is why we fall for the problem of induction, why we confirm. It's why those who study and fare well in school have a tendency to be suckers for the ludic fallacy. And it's why we have black swans and never learn from their occurrence, because the ones that didn't happen were too abstract. Thanks to Vardy, I now belong to the club of single idea people. We love the tangible, the confirmation, the palpable, the real, the visible, the concrete, the known, the seen, the vivid, the visual, the social, the embedded, the emotionally laden, the salient, the stereotypical, the moving, the theatrical, the romanced, the cosmetic, the official, the scholarly sounding verbiage, bullshit, the pompous Gaussian economist, the mathematicized crap, the pomp, the Académie Française, Harvard Business School, the Nobel Prize, dark business suits with white shirts and Ferragamo ties, the moving discourse, and the lurid. Most of all, we favor the narrated. Alas, we are not manufactured in our current edition of the human race to understand abstract matters. We need context. Randomness and uncertainty are abstractions. We respect what has happened, ignoring what could have happened. In other words, we are naturally shallow and superficial, and we don't know it. This is not a psychological problem. It comes from the main property of information. The dark side of the moon is harder to see. Beaming light on it costs energy. In the same way, beaming light on the unseen is costly in both computational and mental effort. Distance from primates. There have been in history many distinctions between higher and lower forms of humans. For the Greeks, there were the Greeks and the barbarians, those people of the north who uttered amorphous sentences similar to the Attic ear to an animal's shrieks. For the English, a higher form of life was the gentleman's, contrary to today's definition. A gentleman's life was practiced through idleness and a code of behavior that included, along with a set of manners, the avoidance of work beyond the necessities of comfortable subsistence. For New Yorkers, there are those with a Manhattan zip code and those with such a thing as a Brooklyn or worse, Queens address. For the earlier Nietzsche, there was the Apollonian compared to the Dionysian. For the better known Nietzsche, there was the Übermensch, something his readers interpret however it suits them. For a modern Stoic, a higher individual subscribes to a dignified system of virtue that determines elegance in one's behavior and the ability to separate results from efforts. All of these distinctions aim at lengthening the distance between us and our relatives among other primates. I keep insisting that, when it comes to decision-making, the distance between us and these hairy cousins is far shorter than we think. I propose that if you want a simple step to a higher form of life, as distant from the animal as you can get, then you may have to denarrate, that is, shut down the television set, minimize time spent reading newspapers, ignore the blogs. Train your reasoning abilities to control your decisions. Nudge System 1, the heuristic or experiential system, out of the important ones. Train yourself to spot the difference between the sensational and the empirical. This insulation from the toxicity of the world will have an additional benefit. It will improve your well-being. Also, bear in mind how shallow we are with probability, the mother of all abstract notions. You don't have to do much more in order to gain a deeper understanding of things around you. Above all, learn to avoid tunneling. A bridge here to what's to come. The Platonic blindness I illustrated with the casino story has another manifestation: focusing. To be able to focus is a great virtue if you're a watch repairman, a brain surgeon, or a chess player. But the last thing you need to do when you deal with uncertainty is to focus. You should tell uncertainty to focus, not us. This focus makes you a sucker. It translates into prediction problems, as we'll see in the next section. Prediction, not narration, is the real test of our understanding of the world.